All right, we begin in Genesis chapter 14 this morning. Genesis 14, verse 1. And it happened in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that these made war on Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinav, king of Admah, Shimeber, king of Zevoim, and the king of Bela, which is Zor. All these had joined the valley of Siddim, the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and they rebelled 13 years. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and struck the Rephaim to Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim and Hem, the Emim at Sheva Kiritaim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir, as far as the plain of Paran, which is by the desert. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, which is Kadesh. They struck all the territory of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwell in Hazazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom went forth with the king of Amorah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zor, and engaged them in battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. All right, I want you to be perfectly honest. How many of you read that this week and thought, boring, when do we get to the good stuff, right? This is the good stuff. You just don't know it. It keeps repeating the names over and over and over again because God is trying to drive something home. Let's make sure we understand something. This is the very first battle recorded in the Bible. Very first battle in the scriptures, which means it is the model for all battles that will ever take place. Every battle in world history, every battle that may take place in world history, this is the model. This is the type. This gives us the internal working so we can understand all warfares. All right? Does that kind of whet your interest a little bit? And the key to understanding what's going on here is understanding the Hebrew names, at least the Hebrew background for each of the names. So it begins, and it happened in the days of, in Hebrew, it's just two words, vayhi bimei. Whenever you see that phrase, vayhi bimei, and it happened in the days of, something bad's going to happen. And you see that phrase about 5 times in the Tanakh, and each time, something really bad's coming down the pike. Now, it may have a good ending later on, but it's like strap in, keep your arms and legs in the car, and do not leave the car until it comes to a complete and full stop, okay? Stay, just strap in. You're going to go through this, but it's going to be a rough ride. And so when it starts with this, you know bad stuff is about to happen. So what we need to do is we need to unpack the names that are listed here. So here they are. Let's understand what these names mean. Amraphel means dark saying. Amer is the word for speak. Vayomer Elohim, and Elohim spoke. And then fell means down, dark, black, just really terrible stuff. And Shinar, shin is the word for tooth. And ear is the word for city, so you can call it Tooth Town. Amraphel, the king of Shinar, you could say Darksein, the king of Tooth Town. Now, whenever you see teeth in the Bible, you don't think dentistry, think consumption, think eating something, consuming. In fact, that first letter, the letter shin, means tooth. That's what the word shin means. And that letter's called a shin. It's supposed to look like a tooth. Doesn't look like a tooth of the roots and the tooth. It's also the word for fire. It makes a shh sound. Because fire and teeth have what in common? They both consume. So we see this very first king, whose name means dark sayings. What would be a dark saying? What would be a saying of light? What would be words of light? Words of light would be truth. So what would be words of darkness? Deception and lies. So we could say, Amraphel, the deceptive speech, king of Tooth Town. Right here, you've got a key. Because all wars begin with deception. People are deceived and believe things. Think of World War II. Hitler himself promoted deception. People believed the deceptions. Because they believed the deceptions, they went to war. And it costs millions of lives. We need to be people of truth and not people of deception. And now these four kings, there's four of them. Amraphel apparently was a leader since he's listed first. In with him is Arioch. Ari means lion. Arioch means lion-like. Okay? And the angel Ariel. Ariel, lion of God, right? Ari. Arioch means lion-like. And who goes about like a lion? Who goes about roaring like a lion? Satan, okay. Lion-like, king of Elisar. God, El-sar, turns aside. Isn't that interesting? People who are fearful of Satan think they've been abandoned by God. But the more you realize that God is with you, he has not turned aside from you, you have no fear of Satan. In fact, we're told in the scriptures, if we'll stand against the enemy, just resist him, just stand against him, he flees from us. He's the one who's afraid of us. And yet so many teachings I hear would make believers afraid of him. The scriptures say, no. You've got the sword of the Spirit. You have the armor. Let him be afraid of you. He's the prince of darkness. You have the light. How do you destroy darkness? Light. He's scared to death of us. But if we are deceived into thinking he's the powerful one, we're the weak one, then we're going to be afraid of him. And the moment you're afraid of him, he has authority and power in your life. And then there's Cheddar Layammer and his lesser-known brother, Mozzarella Layammer. But he... I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that. But Kedar means to bind up, to bind up. Well, we could just talk about binding things up. But what's an omer? An omer is a dry measure. The sheaves are called an omer. But the best we can translate is a binder of sheaves. King of Elam. And Elam... It could be translated, it could possibly be a derivative of Olam, which means the age, or which can also mean hidden, but it's not Olam. It's spelled with a Yud instead of a Vav. So the best we can think of is heaps, because a heap of grain is an Elam. So he's a binder of sheaves, a king of heaps of grain. Okay? Then there's Tidal, which means you shall be cast out. You know, a verb that starts with a tav, it's future. It's what's going to happen to you. And dal means to be cast out. You should be cast out. He's the king of Goyim, king of the peoples. Now you just take those four. It's almost like we have the satanic gospels. We have Dark Sains, the king of Tooth Town, the king of consuming. We have like a lion, king of God turns aside. And then we have the binder of sheaves, king of heaps. What happens when you bind sheaves? You go and you just mow everything down, right? And then you tie it up. You kill it, and then you bind it up. And then you feed on it. Now that's a good thing if you're a farmer. But when you're a warring king, I think the sheaves and the cutting down the heaps is not referring to grain. To people, just death, destruction. You know, what does the Grim Reaper look like in lore? He's always carrying a what? A scythe. That's what you used to reap with. But he's not reaping grain, he's just mowing people down. And this is what our enemy's involved in. He wants to steal and kill and destroy, binding people up. And then This is just hopeless here. The king of the peoples, his name means you should be cast out. Now, these are the four kings who are in charge. These are the four, they're almost like spiritual principles. So when you look at these four kings, it's like they represent the spiritual powers that have control over the five kings. You're going to have a battle here soon between four kings, these four, and five kings. And let's take a look at those five kings. These are Lot's neighbors. Because Lot chose to dwell in Sodom. He decided to make Sodom his home. So we learn here that the king of Sodom is Bera. The first two letters, Bar, means son. We have a bar mitzvah. It means son of the commandment. And the word Ra, Resh Aleph, means evil. So Bara is son of evil. He's the king of Sodom. And Sodom means burning. Or it could mean their secret, because the first two letters, Sod, means secret. Now think about this for a second. Where do we get the word sodomy? From the word Sodom, this town, where sexual perversion just ran rampant in the town because they were burning with lust for one another. But usually people who are addicted to sexual deviance or pornography, what do they want to do? Let's keep that secret. Let's keep it secret. Shh. Right? And the king of Sodom is Bera, the son of evil. And with him in the next town, in the town of Amorah, I don't know why they say Gomorrah. There's no G in it in the Hebrew. It's Amorah. Bersha, their son again. But Arasha is an evil person. Arasha, son of the evil one. King of Amorah. Am means people. Ra here, spelled differently from Ra up here. Ra from the word Yera means fear. People of fear. Son of the evil one. King of the people of fear. Isn't that interesting? Weren't we just talking about fearing the evil one? And Shinav. Sinav would be better pronunciation. Sina means to hate. There's Av. Aleph Beit spells father. Hates father. King of dirt. I like that. King of dirt. Now, most times when you ask someone what they're the king of, they're king of a kingdom, and the kingdom is made up of people. Okay? I rule all these people. But if you're the king of the dirt, all you're looking at is the acreage of your kingdom. You don't care about the people there. But look how vast the acreage is of what I rule. Pardon me? Oh, yes. Sorry, thank you. That's a typo. Should be a mem. And this should be a dalet here. Yeah. I don't know how they got mixed up. You know, I have a Hebrew word processor. Well, I've got three different ones. It depends on what program I'm in. And each one, the keys on the keyboard mean a different Hebrew letter. They're not consistent. It's insane. Thank you for catching that. I will fix that before I put this up on the internet. And by the way, if you're trying to copy all this down, don't worry yourselves with it. Don't wear yourselves out. This will all be on the website. And so you can print it out, because I think this is something you should print out and look at and think about. Okay, thank you, Adam, for pointing that out. Yeah, let me just spell the whole word out here. It's Adama. Aleph, Dalet, Mem, He. Okay, dirt. That's where we get the word Adam. Adam. Adam was made out of the Adama. Okay, and then there's Shimeber. I just call him the celebrity. What his name really means is this. Shem is name, and Aver is a word for the pinion or a wing on a bird flying. You could call it the soaring name. And the commentators simply say it just means he's a celebrity. He's got a big name. But he's the king of hyenas. And if you want to see this in action, just go to, well, don't go to rock concert. Look at a rock concert. Up on the stage, you have the big names, and down on the floor, you got the hyenas. Right? And you see it right back here in Genesis 14. Now, when you look at these, I don't see so much spiritual authorities as I see just physical appetites. And the four kings we saw earlier ruled over these five kings here. And these five kings wanted to rebel against those four. Oh, and then there's a fifth king. His name is not given. But it's a king of Bela. Bela means devouring destruction, which is Zor, which is smallness. And so here's how it all works together. So let's take what we've read so far. I'll shrink it down a bit. I call this political science. You got the five kings, and you've got Lot living here in Sodom. And this is a place of indulging physical appetites. And when you look at the names of the kings, the names of the cities, you can see this reflected, especially as you think about it. All right? And for 12 years, they were paying taxes to the four kings. These four kings were an authority over these five. But in the 13th year, they rebel. They decide, enough of this nonsense, we're not going to pay him anymore. They're going to think, wait a minute, is evil divided against evil? The spiritual principle here, does evil ever get divided against evil? All the time. This is why evil cannot stand. It always collapses under its own weight. It always is self-destructive. Evil always is. This is why Satan's kingdom is doomed from the beginning. It's founded on wickedness and rebellion and sin, therefore is rotten to the core, and it all falls to pieces. It just collapses. We all fall down. It's just what's going to happen. But there's another spiritual principle here. You know, when you look at Sodom, you look at the area where Lot lived and how it pictures the physical appetites. Think of the physical appetites that people can get addicted to. It could be drugs and alcohol. It could be illicit sex, sexual deviance. It could be greed. It could be deception and lying just for lying's sake. You take all these things and they indulge and they want, and they're breaking God's commandments because they want to indulge in these things because of the fun they get from it. But what always happens when you indulge in sin for the sake of fun, every single time the taxpayer comes calling, say, you owe me. But I don't want to pay you. Yeah, but you see, you owe me, because when you begin to yield your bodies to the appetites of the flesh, you become a slave. And now I control you. You take any sin, any violation of a commandment, and the fun, the initial little spark of fun you may have from it, as you continue to indulge that, the fun disappears, and then the price tag shows up, and you have to start paying. The fun level diminishes, but then the misery increases. And just like these five kings, these physical appetites wanted freedom from the spiritual authorities over them, represented by the four kings, that's what happens in life today. You know, over in, I don't know why I didn't think to put this on the screen, it just now occurred to me, but if you go to James just for a moment, go to the book of James. And I think it's right here in the first chapter. And it says in verse 14, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust is conceived, he gives birth to sin. When sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Verse 17, every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be kind of first fruits among his creatures. And I'm looking for the passage where it says, what's the source of wars and fightings among you? It must be in chapter 2. I'm sorry, I should have thought. It just popped into my brain. I thought, let's look this up. Is Brian here? Mr. Concordance? Did I see him walk in? What's the passage? My mind is blanking out. Where it says, what is the source of wars and fightings among you? Is it chapter 4? Thank you, Jenna. Ah, there it is, verse 1. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is it not the source of your pleasures that wage war in your members? That chapter there is describing the spiritual warfare we experience, and it's being illustrated in a schematic right here in Genesis 14. Well, let's continue with this, and we'll pause and take some questions. So, the Torah tells us that these five kings decided to rebel against the four kings who were in authority over them, said, we're not going to pay you anymore. So the four kings say, oh, you think you're going to get away with that? All right, we're coming after you. Now, on the way to the war, they stop off at Rephaim, and they conquer it, fight it. We don't know what happened, but it wasn't good for Rephaim. And also Zuzim and Immim and the Horites and the mountains of Seir. And then they come to the territory of the Amalekites and the Amorites. You want to know what these mean? I didn't put them on the screen. But I think you'll find this interesting. Rephaim means the giants. Zuzim means the commotion. The Immim, the terrors. The Horites, ready for this, the cavemen, the mountains of hair. Seir means hair or hairy. And then there's the Amalekites, people of licking up, and the Amorites, the talkers. And so they just kind of, I guess they get a warm-up for the big war by just going through, tick, 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 let's get all these guys. And then finally, in the Valley of Siddim, they come and attack the five kings. Destroy many of the people, kill many of the people, take all the possessions, take the food, and it gives us a little bit more information if we go on. And it says in verse 10, the Valley of Siddim was full of bitumen wells. The kings of Sodom and Amorah fled and fell into them, while the rest fled to a mountain. They seized all the wealth of Sodom and Amorah and all their food, and they departed, and they captured Lot and his possessions, Abram's nephew, and they left, for he was residing in Sodom. Now, here's what's so fascinating to me. You'd think the five kings would have an advantage, because this is their home turf. They knew about the bitumen wells, these tar pits, or whatever you want to call them. And yet we see them falling into their own pits, and the four kings don't. That's insane. You'd think they would use them to their own advantage. But they fell into them themselves. And how many times does Solomon tell us that the wicked person, they lay a trap and they fall at themselves. They roll a stone downhill, and the righteous man, it rolls back uphill and crushes them. Again, wickedness is self-destructive. And God has placed certain laws in the universe so that when wicked people come against righteous people, I'm not saying these four kings are righteous, but when wicked people exercise wickedness, their wickedness always comes back and destroys them every single time. Just be patient. They can roll that rock down towards you real fast. It takes some time for it to roll back uphill and then crush them, but it will. Just be patient. Just be patient. So what we find here, and I'm going over this quickly, but I've done some of the groundwork so that you can take and think about this, meditate about this, think, how does this apply to my life? Because we are given this wonderful schematic here in Genesis 14 for all warfare, and particularly spiritual warfare. It's right here. And we didn't know it, but it's coded into the text. Take time. Spend some time on this. One of the reasons it's very repetitive, repeating these names, these towns, the names of the towns, the names of the towns, is because God's saying, don't miss this. This is important. Go over it. Review it. Make sure you understand this. But now there's another party involved in this war. Who's the next party? We have the party of the five kings, the party of the four kings. Now we have a third party showing up. Who's the third party? Abraham. Remember, Abraham, his name hasn't been changed to Abraham yet. It's still just Abram. But Abraham means father of multitudes. And Abraham is the father of all believers, of all who believe. Whoever does what Abraham did, God speaks to their hearts and they say yes to him and no to their surroundings and they follow God. You're a child of Abraham. That's what Paul drives home in the book of Romans. And I've been trying to emphasize, Abraham is our picture of the walk of faith. It is the picture of the walk of faith God gives us. And we always go to Abraham when we want to see what a faithful walk with God looks like. Not a perfect walk, but a faithful one. Because part of being faithful is when you fall on your face, you get back up and keep walking. That's faithfulness. Doesn't mean you never fall. It means when you get back, what you do, you get back up and keep going. You keep following. You don't just wallow in guilt. You get up and you dust yourself off and let me get back on track. Do better next time. And I've said over and over, and I'll keep saying it, the narrative in Genesis is very rapid. Until you get to Abraham, boom, God hits the brakes and taps the brakes and slows the whole narrative down. He's saying, okay, this is what I've been in a hurry to get to. Now we've gotten Abraham, I want you to really focus on this man, my friend. Abraham's called the friend of God. So we want to look at Abraham. And when we think of Abraham, do you ever think of Abraham the warrior? But Abraham's a warrior. And I want us to see how he conducts warfare. By the way, a quote from the Midrash Rabbah, the ancient writings, it says, when you see the powers fighting each other, look for the footsteps of King Messiah. When you see the world at war, look for the footsteps of King Messiah. Now it says, let's pick it up in verse 13. Then there came the fugitive. And there's all kinds of imaginative interpretations of who the fugitive is. And told Abram the Ivri, the Hebrew. This is the first time in the story where the word Hebrew is used. And where Abraham is called a Hebrew. Now what does the word Ivri, Hebrew, mean? To cross over. Now he had crossed over the Jordan long before. He had crossed over from idolatry to worship of the one true God long before. But it's here that he's called an Ivri. And I have a theory about that. And it's this. Here we see Abraham for the first time really acting like God. Not trying to be God, but emulating God's ways, God's decision-making, God's character. And by that I mean this. Abraham is about to do for Lot what God had done for Abraham. God pursued Abraham and rescued him out of Ur from idolatry and brought him into the land. And now Abraham is emulating God. And he's going after his nephew, Lot. Now, here's something I want you to keep in mind, too. Abraham, see, I wouldn't have done things like this because I'm not Abraham. I want to grow into an Abraham. But this is what I tend to do. If I had been Abraham and my nephew, Lot, had gone to live in Sodom, I'd always be going down to Sodom, knocking his door, saying, Lot, get out of here. You don't belong here. I'd just be nagging him all the time, sitting in postcards and letters and emails. Lot, come on, man. This is not where you belong. Get back over here. Wham, 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 wham. Abraham didn't do that. There's not one word of Abraham ever going down to Lot, going to Sodom to try to cajole Lot to come back to his senses. Abraham waited till everything fell to pieces, and then he went to help pick them up. I tend to whine and nag people, and then finally their lives go to pieces. Well, they made their minds up. They made their decisions. Nothing I can do about it now. Is that how you are too? Abraham was just the opposite. He let Lot make his decision. He let Lot suffer the consequences of the decision. And finally, when Lot had reached this crisis point, then Abraham pursues him. It helps put his life back together. Now look at the things the characteristics of Abraham. These are some I picked out of the narrative. And you might, I'm sure you'll think of some others. First of all, we notice Abraham was not a pacifist. The Bible does not teach pacifism. It simply does not. Except when it comes to your own personal insult. That's when you turn the other cheek. I don't turn other people's cheeks when they get hurt. I can turn my own. Okay? You understand? And yet so many Christians look at any kind of warfare, any kind of self-defense as revenge. It's not revenge. Self-defense. It's what a good husband does for his wife, a good father does for his children, for his home. It's what a good country does to maintain the freedom of its people when they get attacked. God is not a pacifist. Jesus is not a pacifist. All you got to do is read about him driving the money changers out of the temple 2 times. And then, if that's enough, go to Revelation. He comes back with a sword, with a garment dipped in blood, and he comes to kick butt. Which I shouldn't say in a teaching, but I did. But it's like, there's no pacifism here. Now, he allowed us to do to him what we wanted. And you can insult me, and if I am a mature believer, I'll turn the other cheek. I'll let it go. But I only have one other cheek to turn. And after you hit me twice, I'm out of cheeks. You understand? And there's a time when if we become so pacifist, we lose all the respect of those around us. But we have to be very careful. On the other hand, people who tend to be violent by nature will say, yeah, Grant, yeah, you tell them. And there's a time when we need to be very still and absorb personal insults. And there is a time when we need to stand up and defend our God, defend the faith. But we need to be very careful. We can't just go to extremes, like going to the wells or go to the mountains. We have to avoid the extremes and fight on level territory and do what's necessary. But be very wise. Be very careful. Seek wisdom. Seek counsel whenever you have to make a decision. That's one you cannot back from later on. Just be very wise. Be very cautious. Yes, let's get a microphone over to Jim. Thank you, Bill.
Is both sides, the 4 kings and the 5 kings, both being equal? Is there a spiritual lesson that war is not to be had, period?
No. Good question. A lot of times we see wars where you just have evil people fighting other evil people. But when did Abraham get involved? He got involved to protect the innocent. And that, you know, and as much of a mess as Lot was, he's still called a righteous man in the Bible. Which gives me a lot of hope for myself. And I'm thinking, if Lot's called righteous, maybe I don't have to be quite as hard on myself. But yeah, in Hebrews, in chapter 11, he's called righteous Lot. Go figure. Yeah. So does that answer your question, more or less?
Yeah, it was
okay.
Partially answered, and I wonder if I should ask it or not, but it gave me the idea negotiations should be so trying to accomplish a remedy that there is no more to negotiate.
Yes, you're right. The scriptures command, a good point, the scriptures command us to live peaceably with every man insofar as it's possible, as it's within us to do it. Sometimes you can't live peaceably with another person. And negotiations are wonderful. Compromise is wonderful when we're saying, okay, yeah, we'll give you this territory for that. We'll make things work out here. But when that fails, peace comes only through victory. Peace comes through victory. And just giving up and surrendering to a wicked invader. Yeah, I can get peace that way too. The war is over, but now I'm a slave. And it's better to die than to die fighting than to go into slavery. Yeah. So we see Abraham was not a pacifist. But he battled for the sake of another. When I think of my parents' generation, the greatest generation, and the more I read about that, and I just finished the book about Killing the Rising Sun by Bill O'Reilly about the war in the Pacific, and I just stand in awe of the quality of the men and women of that generation who willingly went to lay down their lives so that we could enjoy freedom. And it's incredible. They did this not for themselves. They did this for their kids, their grandchildren, generations yet unborn. They did it for us. And the things they went through were just unimaginable. And you wonder, do we have the quality people today who could fight World War II if it happened today instead of then? One of the things that's important I want you to see, Abraham did not pray for permission to go and fight these kings. He didn't go before God and say, "Oh Lord, please give me guidance. I want you to tell me what to do." There's an important principle here for us, folks. When someone approaches you and says, "We need help," you don't say, "Well, let me pray about it," and then come back and say, "Well, I don't feel led." Your feelings are what control you. If the scriptures have a clear commandment, and we are commanded to lay down our lives for one another, we're commanded to serve one another, we're commanded to think of others as better than ourselves, to say, "Well, I want to pray about it." I used to say that. I look back, and it was just pure wickedness. It's me not wanting to do it, but giving God the blame. "Well, I asked him, he said no, so take it up with him." Really? And so when you are asked to serve, you know, I can imagine this. Standing before God on Judgment Day someday, and God looks at us and he says, "So-and-so came to you to help, ask you to help out with something. And you told that person no because you didn't feel led. Why did you do that?" And you say to God, well, "God, I asked you what I should do and you were silent." He says, "Yeah, because I sent that person to ask you and tell you what I wanted you to do." You understand? Don't have a wicked heart that blames God for your own laziness or lack of obedience, your lack of humility and desire to serve. Now again, are there times you need to pray to get clarity? Of course there are. But I remember when I was first asked to lead this congregation, I said, "Oh no, I don't feel led. I mean, that's not going to happen. God doesn't want me to." God had other plans. And I've used this excuse so many times in my life that I have just made a promise myself never to use it again. If there's a clear path ahead of what I'm supposed to do, I just do it. Sometimes going to prayer is the wrong thing when action is required and the scriptures have given you a clear path. You act. But it takes wisdom and maturity to know the difference. You understand? There are other times I really want to rush in and act. God says, "Whoa, hold your horses, step back. No, 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 I don't need you here." So it does take wisdom. It takes maturity. It takes sensitivity. But I just pray that none of us here will ever say, "Well, I don't feel led," when really, you just didn't want to, but you should. Let's make sure we understand. But he did trust God for help, as we're going to see as we read on. And then it says, I think it's in verse 14. It says, "And when Abraham heard that his kindred was taken captive, he armed his disciples." I love that. He armed his disciples, his students. And this is what discipleship is all about. And people keep asking, when is our discipleship program going to get started? We're working on it. Okay, we have our first really big meeting to start planning this out on Monday. And I hope you'll be praying for when the groups of elders get together as we really begin to hammer this out on Monday evening. So we're very keen to get started on this. And I just got asked again last night, when are we going to start the discipleship? Because we want to arm the students. And it's something we take very seriously. And we want to do it right, okay? So we don't want to give you a bunch of weapons, go out there and cut each other up. We want it to be something where you really, we really make an impact in your lives and you make an impact in the world. So he armed his disciples. He did not give up because the way was long and difficult. Because look what it says. 318 of his disciples pursued them as far as Dan, verse 14. How far is Dan? Very, just right up on almost the very northern tippy top of Israel. Verse 15. And he, with his servants deployed against them at night, struck them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is to the north of Damascus. Damascus is clear outside of Israel. That's up in what modern day Syria, but he went north of that. I mean, me, I'd have gone 5 miles, 10. This is a lost cause. They have such a head start on us. This is way. They probably have killed them all anyway. What's the use? But he didn't give up. He made up his mind. He knew what the right thing was to do. He did not give up. Now I want you to think about something too. Remember when Abraham came into Canaan, God says, I want you to walk through the land, the east, the west. I want you to go the north and the south. And Abraham did the east-west part, but he didn't do the north-south part. So what did God do? Brought a famine. So Abraham decided, oh, they've got food in Egypt. I'm going to go to Egypt. Egypt is to the south of Israel. Then he comes back, kind of embarrassed because he lied about his wife. And now Lot's captured. Now Abraham is going all the way to the north. In other words, Lot didn't just follow through obediently exploring the land the way God told him to. So God brought adversity, which caused him to fulfill the commandment. It's almost as if God's saying you can go easy or you can go hard, but you're going to go. You're going to fulfill the commandment. You might ask yourself, what adversity am I going through right now that is finally making me do the thing I should have done long ago? Because that's what we see happening with Abraham. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. But he didn't give up. And then, as you go on down through here, he rescues Lot, his family. Verse 16, he brought back all the possessions. He also brought back his kinsman, Lot, with his possessions, as well as the women and the people. So his rescue of Lot had a wonderful effect on a much larger group. His heart was for Lot, but he turned out rescuing many at the same time. And then you go to verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, he approaches him. Actually, verse 17. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after he's returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him to the valley of Shaveh, which is the Kidron Valley, by the way, just to the east of Jerusalem, which is the king's valley. In verse 21, the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people, take the positions for yourself. That's your, you keep the booty. You get to keep all the loot. Verse 22, Abram said to the king of Sodom, I lift up my hand to Adonai God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth, if so much as a thread to a shoe strap, or if I shall take from anything of yours. So you shall not say, it is I who made Abram rich. Far from me. Only what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who accompanied me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, they will take their portion. He refused payment. He doesn't do God's will for the sake of money. He just wasn't going to do it. And he wasn't going to share the glory with the king of Sodom. So Sodom could say, yeah, Abraham, all this wealth, that was my generosity. I let him keep all the loot when he helped us out. Abraham says, no, none of that. So he would not give glory to another. Can you see, are there any others I've missed that maybe you see as we're going through here that we see about Abram the warrior? And when you think of Abraham from now on, recognize that he is a warrior. He was a great warrior. Now here it doesn't talk about death and destruction, but when you go to Hebrews and you read about this, Hebrews chapter 7, it calls it the slaughter of the kings. Who slaughtered them? Abraham did and his men. There was bloodshed. It was violent. Okay, I see Adam's hand up, so let's get a microphone to Adam. Can you just throw that thing, Bill, and Adam can catch it with that one?
Two things that jumped out at me that weren't on the list. One was the size of his army. It was 318 men.
Small army, yeah.
I need to picture more people. And the other one I thought, which kind of jumped out at me, was the fact that he says, but, you know, my trained men, they'll take their share.
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting. There's this balance of saying, no, I don't need your stuff, but we'll give it to them. You know, so there's a balance of recognizing I'm a made man. You know, good God made me, it's clear, but... They can have the loot.
Yeah, he did not deny others. Yeah, good point. Now, speaking of the size of his army, why does it give exactly 318? When a number is given like that, it always has significance. I don't claim to know the significance, but you know what the rabbis say? They say 318 just happens to be the numerical value of Eliezer. Let's see, I hope I spelled this right. Eliezer equals 318. Doesn't mean he just took Eliezer with him and the two guys wiped everybody out. But Eliezer, what's he a picture of? I think when we get to chapter 19, we'll find Abraham sending Eliezer to find a bride for his son Isaac. Eliezer, which means my God helps. You've heard of Ebenezer? That's got the word Ezer in it, Ezer. Ebenezer means rock of my help. Eben is rock. Eliezer, my God helps. Ebenezer is rock of help, my rock of help. Eliezer is a picture of the Holy Spirit. He's the one the Father sends to find a bride for the Son. That's the Holy Spirit's job. That was Eliezer's job, we'll see in a few chapters. So it's as if the word is giving us some hints here that this is a picture of spiritual warfare, and it was fought in the power of the Holy Spirit. It wasn't just physical strength. If Abraham was depending on physical strength, he'd taken a lot more than 318 men. 318 is nothing when you're going up against four kings who are battle-hardened, who have already conquered all these other places and now conquered these five kings. Are you kidding me? They must have had massive armies. Yet with 318 men, Abraham wipes them out. Pretty incredible. Really amazing. There was another. Tony had his hand up. Yes.
Abraham, he was raised in a pagan culture.
Yes.
He forsook everything that he had learned. We have a tendency not to let go of a lot of things that we've learned in error. He left it all. In other words, all those false gods, all those false, he left it all and he left the land. That's something we have to really consider. Would we be willing to do all of that?
Yeah.
And how much, you know, when I share what I believe, the hardest people that I deal with are the ones that have been brought up in some sort of religious teaching. And they want to hold on to the traditions. Yeah. The you know, it's really bad.
Yeah, I agree. It's something we're called upon to do all the time, is to let go of preconceived notions. You remind me, I want to read this quote from A.W. Tozer, who is truly a godly, godly man. You know, he's not buried too far from here, just over in Ellet, in fact. His grave is there, and you can visit. It just says, A.W. Tozer, a man of God. That's all it says, a little rock there on his tombstone. But listen to what he says. The most portentous fact about any man is not what he, at a given time, may say or do, but what he is, what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. Let me read that part again. We'll go on. The most portentous thing. Portentous means the thing is going to determine the path a man takes. Determines how he walks through life. The most portentous fact about any man is not what he at a given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. Were we able to extract from any man a complete answer to the question, what comes to your mind when you think about God? We might predict with certainty the spiritual future of that man. How you think about God will determine who you become. You aren't just the byproduct of nature and nurture. You are a byproduct of your God picture. And that internal picture of God determines how you see everything else. Most of our problems are not circumstantial. Most of our problems are perceptual. Our biggest problems can be traced back to an inadequate understanding of who God is. Now get this last sentence, the last two sentences. Our problems seem really big because our God seems really small. In fact, we reduce God to the size of our biggest problem. Isn't that the truth? This is why when Paul writes a letter, he starts out by talking about who God is, who Messiah is, like he wants to stretch our perception of who God is and make it bigger. And the first half of every letter he writes is getting a better picture of who God is. Then the last half is, now here's how you live. This is what you do. This is what you do about it. But trying to do these things will have a picture of who God is pretty futile. And this really concerns me when people come to the Torah trying to obey it, but they don't have a good concept of who the God of the Torah is. We have to change the way we think about God, and the way we think of him should be growing and expanding, coming to sharper focus all the time, every day. And that will affect everything we do, every decision we make, the way we treat every person, every relationship. Everything we do will be affected by that. I can't stress that enough. I think A.W. Tozer really hit the nail on the head with those words. So let's make sure our concept of God is accurate. And as Tony is saying, Abraham, take his concept of God and completely put it on the trash heap and start over. And God was welcome to introduce himself and to teach Abraham about who he was. Yes, Valerie. I noticed the people who raise their hands sit the furthest away from Bill with a microphone. Now, if you sit up here, Bill, they'll raise their hands back there. You know that's how it works. Yes, Valerie.
Do we have any idea how old Abraham is during this time? I mean, to gain the respect of even 318 men being willing to go and fight for him or another, how old is he?
I'm guessing the 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm. He's a warrior in that age?
Abraham and I have this in common, that we are very robust for our age. Now, that was unnecessary. Yeah, well, you know, when people, they did live longer then. He lived to be 100 and some years old. So now whether he did much of the fighting himself or just was the general, I don't know. But he's still the one we credit with the victory here. Yeah. Yes, and Steve in the back. Thanks, Val.
I see a little comparison here between Abraham and Gideon. Gideon's a large group, and it can be cut down because at the end, the glory went to God. He's the one that actually...
Exactly.
We're not told specifically, but I got a feeling that
yes. Yeah, you bring up a great point, Steve. God uses small things to accomplish big things. And I think he likes to use small things. Here's a principle. The bigger something is in size and mass and weight and dimensions, that means that it's invested its essence in the physical rather than the spiritual. But the smaller something is, means it has not invested much in the physical. Therefore, its essence is invested more in the spiritual. So look at all the miracles that are worked where God uses small things. Moses, stretch your staff over the Red Sea. Go wash in the Jordan River. It's a small little river. It's about as wide as from me to the front pew here where Heather said. It's not a very big river. Sinai was not up on a big mountain. It's one of the smaller mountains. God uses small people and small things to accomplish big things. And when something's too big physically, he usually has to cut it down to size before he can use it. He has to reduce its physicality to increase its spirituality. It's just a principle. It's an amazing principle in Scripture, and I love it. Yes, Robin. Oh, wait a minute. Wait till Bill gets the microphone up to you. There we go.
And I won't call you my lovely bride this time. I'll be very careful about that.
One of the things that the histories tell us about Abraham, the thing that made him who he was to be so respected and trusted, is that he was a man of great hospitality.
Yes.
And he had spent years and years listening and being available to people and letting them know that they matter, because they do. And they say that the tents, the flaps of his tent were open to welcome people into his life.
Yes.
He made himself available and humble and vulnerable. He served people. So he didn't set himself up as a mighty warrior and impose himself, but he served them. And that's probably how he equipped them.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. He invested his life in people. I mean, he had 318 disciples that he armed. Where they come from for years, and they listened to him as he taught them the things he learned and invested his life in them. And that turned into real, real victory in war. Yeah. Thank you. That was a great point. Now, in the email I sent out, I made a slight typo. I said there are two verses here that they weren't in the chapter. You wouldn't notice anything missing in the narrative. It should have said three verses. Sorry about that. But I like to keep you on your toes. You get these three verses that I know we're going to go over just a little bit, and I won't take much time. But it says in verse 18, "But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God, the Most High, El Elyon. He blessed him, saying, 'Blessed is Abram of God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God, the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand.' And he," Abram, "gave him," Melchizedek, "a tenth of everything." And then the next verse just picks up where it left off. I mean, think about it. Look at verse 17. "The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him to the valley of Sheba, which is the king's valley." Verse 21. "The king of Sodom said to Abram, 'Give me the people.'" See what I'm saying? Verse 21 follows verse 17. I mean, it looks like they're meant to go right together, but God kind of opens the text up and inserts these three verses about, has nothing to do with anything in the story. And yet, those three verses are the most amazing three verses, really, in the chapter, introducing Melchizedek. And it says that he was the king of Salem. Salem is Jerusalem. Salem can be Shalom, peace. Jerusalem's Yerushalayim, the city of peace. But the word, the way it's pronounced here in the text, is the word Shalem. And Shalem, which our English translations call Salem, is Jerusalem. Psalm 76, 1 and 2 says, "God is known in Judah, his name is great in Israel, and his tabernacle is in Shalem," Salem. "His dwelling place also is in Zion." So it's referring here, David's letting us know that this place where this takes place, where Melchizedek is the king, is in Jerusalem. And the valley of Sheba is the Kidron Valley, right there to the east of the Golden Gate. And one of the other things that's amazing about this, it says that he's the king of Salem. In Hebrew, it's Melech Shalem. And Dan taught us the word Melech, king. Melech Shalem. You know that word, that phrase can be translated perfect king? Because the word shalem means perfect. It's the root of shalom. Shalom, peace, doesn't come from the absence of conflict, but from completeness. And perfection is always something that's complete. This is why in Paul, in one of his passages, talks to, "And those of you who are perfect," isn't mean perfect, it means that you're mature, you're complete. And so Melech Shalem, king of Salem, can also mean the perfect king.
Melchizedek is Melech Tzadik. There's the word king again. Righteous king. King of righteousness. So the king of righteousness, the perfect king, king of Jerusalem. And the first time you see the word priest in the Bible is right here. The very first priest in the Bible is Melchizedek. First one to be mentioned. And I'm going to stop here for a second. If you don't hear anything else, hear this. When you think of priests, you tend to think of Levitical priests that come later in the book of Exodus, right? You try to study the priests, and that's all wonderful, that's all good. You have to realize, though, that those are all pictures of the ultimate original priest, who is Melchizedek. The first priest in the Bible is Melchizedek, which means he is the picture, he is the type, he is the standard for all priests to come. You don't try to understand Melchizedek by looking at the Levitical priest. You understand the Levitical priest by looking at Melchizedek. He's the standard. He's the original. He predated them. And of course, everything about Melchizedek is a picture of who? Messiah. Our King of Righteousness. Our perfect King. The King of Jerusalem. The one who brings out bread and wine. Blesses Abraham, who's the father of all the Jewish people and all the Gentile believers. And the greater blesses the lesser. He's blessing Abraham. And Abraham pays him tithes. You pay tithes to the one who's greater, not to the one who's lesser. And he's the original priest. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Hebrews chapter 7, which I know wouldn't have time to go over today. Study that this week. Hebrews chapter 7. Where the writer of Hebrews unpacks who Melchizedek is. But in Psalm 110:4 is the only other place Melchizedek is mentioned in the Tanakh. It says, Adonai has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And that phrase, order of Melchizedek, is Devarti. And there's Melchizedek. Melchizedek is actually two words. King of righteousness. And Devarti means the word of. So here God is speaking to David and says, you're a priest by the word of the King of Righteousness, by his word. Now this Psalm 110 is a fascinating, very mystical, very difficult to understand psalm. But it's also very short. Just listen to it for a moment. Because you're going to hear echoes of Genesis 14 in the psalm. This is what it says. The Psalm of David. Adonai said to my master, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Enemies become the footstool, conquering enemies. Adonai will send your powerful scepter out from Zion so that you will rule over your enemies around you. On the day your forces mobilize, and the word for mobilize there is really volunteer. These are volunteer, just like Abraham's disciples were. Your people willingly offer themselves in holy splendors from the womb of the dawn. The dew of your youth is yours. Adonai has sworn it, he will never retract. You are a Kohen, a priest, forever, to be compared with Melchizedek. Adonai at your right hand will shatter kings on the day of his anger. He will pass judgment among the Goyim, the nations, filling it with dead bodies. He will shatter heads throughout an extensive territory. He will drink from a stream as he goes on his way. Therefore, he will hold his head high. That all this talk about Melchizedek in Psalm 110, the only mention of Melchizedek elsewhere in the Tanakh is in the context of warfare. And the first time Abraham is called an Ivri, one who crosses over, is in the context of war. The first time priest is used is in the context of warfare. And it's almost as if when you put all these ingredients together, it's as if God's saying, you really want to be a son of Abraham, must be involved in spiritual warfare. You have to pick sides. You must take up your weapon, the sword of the Spirit. Learn how to use it skillfully. Use it against the enemy. Don't use it against your neighbor. And don't depend on your physical strength. Depend on his Spirit. And go into war not to make a name for yourself or to get rich, but to rescue the innocent whose lives have been shattered. Use it for their sake. and I'll give you victory. You understand? There are a lot of components here. And it's an amazing story that we can learn from. And I hope we'll camp out at this chapter over the next few days and really read it with new eyes. And Adam will give you the last word. So let's get a microphone over to Adam.
As we're going over the very first part, going name by name with the people, there were parts of it that to me just really jumped out and said, doesn't that remind you of your culture?
Yes.
The celebrities,
the
lies, even the sodomy, to accumulate possessions and to be a consumer. And then I think about how this is the first time Abram was called one who crossed over. And I think it's a message, that title is almost a message to Lot, but also to us, where we say, I can go down to this world. I can lie a little bit and surround myself by liars. I can be under authority by, pompous celebrity. I can consume. And also, it starts to paint this picture of the world that we immerse ourselves in if we don't remember
such
we're not
a
king of this world. And then there's the crossing over and recognizing that unless we do engage in that warfare and we separate ourselves, we have to know where our king is.
Yeah. And just as Lot was taken captive by the things he tolerated, we will be taken captive by the things we tolerate. Yeah, good point. All right, I'm going to stop there. A couple more verses here that you can look at later. Exodus 19:6 and Revelation 1, verses 5 to 6, which talks about us being a kingdom of priests. But we're not Levitical priests. We're priests after the order of Melchizedek. And the last question before we end, what's the primary difference between the priesthood of Melchizedek and the priesthood of Levi? Levites brought animal sacrifices, but the order of Melchizedek, the priest, is the sacrifice. We are priests according to the order of Melchizedek, and we are invited to make our bodies living sacrifices. That is the difference. We're the sacrifices. And when we read about animal sacrifices, that's to teach us about ourselves and also what Messiah accomplished. He gave himself a sacrifice. We give ourselves as a sacrifice. We don't have to use animals. You understand? So we'll close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for this time together, for these wonderful words of Torah. Lord, I pray that you speak deeply to our hearts and we become wiser and more effective students, more effective warriors, more effective disciples, and that we might, as your children and as children of Abraham, reflect his faithfulness and reflect your holiness. Make us the people you want us to be. We'll give you the praise and glory for it all in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.